1967 is a year that Green Bay Packers fans and fans of pro football in general will recall as the year of the first Super Bowl. Packers 35, Chiefs 10, by the way. Back up a few decades now to 1920, the official founding of the National Football League. But what happened before that? Pro football in America didn't just appear in 1920. Not only is there a nearly three-decade history of professional football before then, that story includes a game-fixing scandal that almost killed the sport in the country altogether. Our next guest spent about a decade researching that history, which includes a family connection to it all. And as the NFL's preseason gets underway, we're going to take a look way back at where it all started. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the origins of pro football in the United States? Is this something you have followed or looked into yourself? Do you happen to have any family connections that date back to the early days of pro football? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Greg Fisseri is a native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His new book is called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is an amazing journey in the book, Greg, and it started off with you going through your great-grandpa's photos. Can you tell us what kicked off this project for you?
That's right. I knew growing up in Pittsburgh at my grandmother's house in a little industrial suburb called Wilmerding, about 10 miles east of the city, that he was one of the greats of the pre-NFL era. He was a center before the forward pass, so he was a key to the offensive line. And the forward pass was legalized in 1906. And he played for every world championship team in Pittsburgh and in Massillon, Ohio, from 1901 to 1906. So there were a few pictures on her wall that gave me put me on the scent, but it wasn't until she passed away in 2007 and I was cleaning out her house that I discovered the real treasure, which was a box of dozens of more original photos from his career, individual photos, team photos, buddy pictures. Some were identified, some weren't, and it led me to ask a lot of questions, find resources, find people that could help me identify the whole lot. And once I had it, sort of the story together, I ended up going to the Hall of Fame in 2012, and they really were amazed and validated how unique the whole collection was, that they hardly had anything from that period. And there is still much to be told about the story of that period and the for the original pioneers of the game that had been lost. So
I want to take this. I want to set the scene now with the early days, the first paid pro football players. Now, the college sport was big in the United States at this point. The rules that separated American football as we know it now from, you know, soccer and rugby had been in place for a couple decades now. It's a big college sport. Not a lot of interest initially in watching it at the pro level. Set that scene. What was America's attitude toward amateur and pro football at this time?
Correct. College football officially started in 1869. We had CFB 150 in 2019, 150 years. Princeton and Rutgers in New Jersey was the first game in 1869. The Scarlet Knights of New Jersey wore little red Scarlet caps on their heads. And from there, the Ivy League ran with it. Harvard, Yale, Princeton were the big three. Penn came a little bit later, but they dominated the sport. And into the 1890s, it was then, you know, played at an amateur level, governed by the AAU, Amateur Athletic Union, covered and sort of supervised national championship sports in basketball, swimming, wrestling, and several sports. So if you were going to compete in anything AAU, it had to be at an amateur level. Professionalism was seen as sort of unethical, and it wasn't supported by the general public. So when football, you know, became popular at the adult level and played at many clubs, the main five in Pittsburgh were sponsored because there was a lot of money in the Industrial Revolution in Pittsburgh by companies. Homestead Steel became Carnegie Steel, became U.S. Steel. Homestead Steel sponsored a team that was the Western Pennsylvania champion in 1900 and sort of initially called the world champions in 1901 because they played a team from Philadelphia outside of Pittsburgh. And this was the first effort, really, to professionalize the sport. Eventually, somebody would get paid cash, and that would define the first pro player. So, and in 1892, it was discovered by the Hall of Fame when they opened in 1963 that a player named William Pudge Heffelfinger from Yale, an All-American, had received $500 in cash to play for them, for the Allegheny Athletic Association against their rival Pittsburgh Athletic Club. So they found this accounting ledger that they call the birth certificate of pro football, and it's on display in the Hall of Fame that showed that Heffelfinger got paid $500 in cash, which was a huge sum at that point, to play one game. And that defined the beginning of the pro era. So it went on in Pittsburgh from 1892 until 1902. And my great-grandfather played. His name was Bob Shiring for this Homestead team in 1901 that was the world championship team. And that was, at that point, the first picture I had of him on a football team. And that really started the journey. When the Hall of Fame said, you know, if you can combine these photos you have with a narrative that is missing the solution to an alleged gambling scandal in 1906 in which the championship games between the Maslin Tigers and Canton Bulldogs in Ohio may have been rigged, you could really have something special.
Talking to Greg Fisseri. His new book is called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. It can be hard to imagine today with the height of the NFL, but pro football was once a touch-and-go operation. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about the early days of football. That's 800-642-1234. If you've dug into the family history of someone like Greg and your family who was involved in the early days of football, maybe with a little team out of Green Bay, I don't know. Join in at 800-642-1234. Greg, I want to bring it home to Wisconsin a little bit here. Now, in the era you described before that gambling scandal, which we're going to get into in just a bit, teams were competing for players, and there were some hot commodities from a college in the Midwest called the University of Wisconsin. There were some players in high demand from here, right?
That's right. The Maslin Tigers recruited the entire Badgers backfield, three running backs, right in the midst of the 1906 season to give them an extra edge to get past the rival Canton Bulldogs. That's a great find.
Now, you mentioned there were two superpower teams in Ohio, and it culminates in 1906 in this weird, kind of complicated payoff scandal. Give us the broad strokes. How much trouble did this put pro football in at that time? How big an impact did the, tell us a little bit about the scandal and how it almost jeopardized pro football in the U.S.
Sure. So as the facts became clear, it turned out to be true. As the Maslin newspaper reported after the second of the two championship games between the Tigers and the Bulldogs that year, one of the Tigers players had received $50,000 to offer to various players in a pool to get them to fix the outcomes of these games, and they wanted them to split them and then perhaps play a third game for and get more people to come and buy more tickets and so on. Rumors were circulating, and there were denials made, and the games went on, and as it turned out, they did split those games, and that led more people to believe that the games were fixed. So the Massillon paper came out with a story the following day after a big bar fight broke out in which some people accused the Canton players of fixing the games, and they denied it, and somebody went through the glass window just like in a Burt Reynolds movie. But the story in the Massillon paper did admit that there was an attempted bribe and that they kicked the player off of their team for doing so. And they also accused the Canton captain, Blondie Wallace, of colluding in this scam. And he vigorously denied it. And even the other player from Massillon who participated denied it, that Wallace was involved, but nonetheless, he could never clear his name. So as that trial, and he sued the Massillon paper for libel, as that trial dragged on for a couple of years, people lost patience and lost interest in the game. And they didn't trust that it was on the up and up. So it dragged, the effects of it dragged on basically from 1906 until 1915. Football continued to be played, but it went back to the local and amateur semi-pro level at best, and just lost the instant popularity that it had gained when all the best players in the country had been attracted to that Eastern Ohio. So it wasn't until Jim Thorpe came back around and was recruited by a fellow named Jack Cusack, who volunteered to run the second version of the Canton Bulldogs. He was actually the ball boy or equipment kid for Canton back in the first era in 1906, and he loved the experience so much he stepped up and said he wanted to help resurrect the game. And it was his idea to bring Jim Thorpe in after Thorpe had won the gold medals for the decathlon and pentathlon in the 1912 Olympics. He was the world's greatest athlete, national icon, and they thought if Thorpe played, people would come back. And they were right. People loved Jim Thorpe, and he brought thousands of fans to the games.
We're talking with Greg Fisseri about his new book. It's called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about the early days of pro football, before there even was a National Football League? This conversation bringing back memories for you about maybe stories you heard from family members or others about the old days of pro football. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the early days of professional football in America. Our guest is Greg Fisseri, author of the new book, Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest about the pre-NFL days. Let's bring on a caller now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Hey, Marcus.
Hey, Rob. So my thought that I've had for a while just about pro football is, what if we went back to something more resembling like the original helmets and pads, not the leather ones, but where they just had the one, you know, small chin strap or whatever, and you know, less shoulder pads and what, because I think that there'd be less CTE in terms of brain injuries as well as just other injuries, because the players could no longer be guided human missiles.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Greg, can you paint us a picture? What kind of padding and protective gear were these players wearing and not wearing when they played in this era?
They weren't wearing much more than some canvas pants and some knit jerseys. They had the option to stitch in some padding into their shoulders and maybe stick some wooden slats into their thighs. But I've heard that thought over the past few years, and my reaction to that is it probably wouldn't work very well. In fact, in 1905, more than 20 players died from football-related injuries, not necessarily on the field, but broken necks, backs, head injuries, and so on. And a lot of that had to do with the rules at the time, which included a flying wedge formation in which it was a V formation, and the runner got behind the V and they sort of attacked the weakest link on the defense. And it was pretty brutal. So 1906 became a transformational year with the rules when President Teddy Roosevelt forced some rule changes to try to fix the game. People thought he might kill it, but he didn't. He liked the game. He liked the concept of masculine Christianity and the Rough Riders from the military that he put together. But so he got some of the luminaries of the game, Walter Camp, Amos Alonzo Stagg, John Heisman, to form a committee that became the NCAA to implement a line of scrimmage and the forward pass and 10 yards instead of 5 for a first down. Things to open up the game, because it was so brutal before that. So I think probably the more pads we have and the better, but I don't know how to, I'm not sure any helmet is going to solve the injury issue at the pace that these men play at.
Marcus, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Greg Fisseri about his new book, Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story, looking at the early days, the pre-NFL days. We're talking over 100 years ago of professional football here in the United States. Greg, can you talk a little more about what the game looked like? If an NFL fan of today went back and watched a game, what do you think might stand out about the action on the field and the tactics involved?
It wouldn't feel like there was much action if you've already seen what it's become today. I think it was a lot of, they called them mass plays, sort of like rugby. One of the main changes in the rule that diverted American football away from rugby was the snapback, which, sort of breaking up plays from a constant – the constant movement and scrums in rugby. So it was just a lot of pushing and shoving the ball down the field, sort of like a contest of strength. But slowly, I think the game became faster and faster, and fits and starts with rule changes. 1906, as I said, was pivotal. But even with the first forward pass, and by the way, my great-grandfather snapped the ball for the first forward pass with the Massillon Tigers in 1906. Fun footnote. But it was a fumble when there was an incomplete pass. So it wasn't like they were chucking the ball, 40 times a game right away.
Now, I'm looking at pictures, and you've got a lot of great pictures in your book, Greg. Your great-grandpa looks like a pretty big guy by the standards of the time. By the standards of modern-day NFL, I'm guessing even he would look pretty tiny lined up on an offensive line.
Yeah, Big Bob Shiring, as he was called, was about 240, 250 at center, and pretty dominant with the 6 straight world championships. So there were several players, the backs, quarterbacks, running backs, 160 to 180 pounds was about it. There was a fellow named Arthur Poe from Princeton, who was a relative of Edgar Allan Poe, and he was an All-American, great, fast player, and his knee would pop out all the time. They hit during the middle of the game, so they would stop the game. But he went about 170 pounds at best.
Now, Greg, you mentioned we had this attempted bribery scandal, and your great-grandpa said no to this, by the way, but we had this attempted bribery scandal in Ohio. It set back pro football, but the teams are talking about this Ohio center of gravity in pro football. In a lot of ways, this set the stage for the formation of the NFL, 14 years later, right?
Absolutely. After the initial Pittsburgh era for 10 years, which is the birthplace. Canton still calls itself the cradle of pro football, which people don't quite get the nuance, but they recognize that they weren't the birthplace, but they have the Hall of Fame because the NFL was founded there in 1920, not because pro football started there. But nonetheless, it really matured there and was reborn there with Jim Thorpe and led to the founding of what was first called the American Pro Football Association in 1920 and 21, but they changed the name to the National Football League. But that's where the game really flourished.
And Greg, I got to ask, you mentioned seeing some of those photos up on the wall and then finding more of them. Do they have a prominent place in your home now?
Absolutely. Those three main larger frame ones still inhabit the wall of my billiard room, just like they did in my grandmother's billiard room. And it was pretty rare for a grandparent back in those days, especially in Pittsburgh, to have a billiard room. And most of the time they were cellars, very raw and you know, dirty. But she had a very elegant home in her community, which set them apart from many others there. And it made me feel like they were something special. And they were special because of my great-grandfather's legacy and the patriarch of the family that he was as a successful businessman and leader in their community as a justice of the peace after his pro football career. So his legacy of character and integrity, it's really special because imagine that he was an eighth grade graduate only from Pittsburgh who had to go to work at the Westinghouse Air Brake Corporation to help his family. And he rose to the peak of pro football surrounded by Ivy League educated players who were the best in the country from elite institutions, and they made him their captain. So that's very powerful to me and inspired me to understand more about him.
Greg, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much. It's at gridironlegacy.com. Greg, if you'd like a signed copy.
Greg Fasseri is the author of the new book, Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story.